You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
Why keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro?
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, November 26, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Marvin Amory on the death of net neutrality. Also, Adam Green on the livingness of Social Security and more. Also on the program today, Pope Francis sounding shrill as he comes out against the tyranny of global capitalism. Blockbuster report on the implications, or I should say, that rewrites the EPA's estimates on how much methane is leaking into the atmosphere as a byproduct of fracking. This is going to have big policy implications, if not global warming implications going forward. Or I should say, vice versa. We will tell you the story of Franksgiving, which has been going around. And a new poll talks about the unprecedented level of anxiety amongst Americans, particularly Americans in the bottom half of the income spectrum, as to maintaining their jobs. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Not surprising, but perhaps a little bit disturbing. A poll came out today, the generic ballot, 2014 generic ballot poll, just to give you a sense of the damage that politically, the toll that it has taken on the prospects for the Democrats in the fall from the poor rollout of the Affordable Care Act. In October, following the government shutdown, the generic ballot for Democratic candidates was 50%, Republicans at 42%. That has now reversed. Republican candidate 49%, Democratic candidate 47%. It just gives you a sense of when we hear of the implications of any event on our politics, you've always got to wait 3 weeks, maybe 4 weeks, to see if that is going to ring true. So this story is a fun story, actually, and particularly important relative to that story about this new methane report, at least in this country. But in Norway, the Norwegian army has now gone on a vegetarian diet, at least for Mondays. They are doing meatless Mondays in the Norwegian military. It said it plans to put its troops on a vegetarian diet once a week in a bid to fight climate change. The Army said its new Meatless Mondays are meant to cut its consumption of ecologically unfriendly foods whose production contributes heavily to global warming. They're, of course, talking about the factory farming of livestock. It's a step to protect our climate. The idea is to serve food that's respectful of the environment, said spokesman Einstein Kvarving to the AFP News Service. It's not about saving money, says Kvarving. It's about being more concerned for our climate, more ecologically friendly, and also healthier. So there you have it, Meatless Mondays. We do it at our house, although we don't always do it on Monday. We do at least one meatless day a week. For health reasons, you know, we buy, to the extent that we eat meat, we generally buy it from a farm that we know of, or farmer's market. So, but it's also healthier to not have meat at every meal, every dinner. Also, this is a happy story, as it were. A federal court has ruled, the U.S. District Judge Thomas Durkin in Chicago ordered a Cook County clerk to issue an expedited marriage license to Vernita Gray and Patricia Ewart. As you know, Illinois' gay marriage law will take effect June 1 of 2014. But the gay rights group Lombada Legal and the American Civil Liberties Union of Illinois filed a lawsuit seeking an immediate action for Gray and Ewart. Gray, sadly, has a terminal cancer in both her brain and her bones. And she wanted the opportunity to marry the woman she loves before she dies. They're concerned that she will not make it till the June 1st, and a federal court has ordered the county clerk to issue a marriage license, and the county clerk has said he'll comply with the order. So both, I guess, a sad story, but also one that is heartwarming. I have an idea. Why not just let all people who want to get married in Illinois do so now? But there we go. Hopefully, in the not too distant future, this will never be an issue for any American living anywhere, healthy or sick. All right, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, first, we're going to talk to Marvin Amori. I recorded this conversation last week on the death of net neutrality, following which I will come back, and then we will intro Adam Green, an interview I also did last week from the Progressive Change Caucus Committee. All right, we'll be right back after this. We are back on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Marvin Amori. He is currently the 2013 Bernard L. Schwartz Fellow at the New America Foundation, also an attorney in private practice. Welcome to the program, Marvin.
Thanks, Sam. It's great to be on.
You wrote earlier this month in Wired that net neutrality is a dead man walking. First off, before we get into this court case that is that was argued, I guess, back in September in the D.C. Circuit Court, What, just broadly, just tell us what net neutrality is.
Net neutrality is the concept that essentially AT&T, Comcast, Verizon, companies that give you access to the internet, shouldn't be allowed to set themselves up as sort of toll booths or gatekeepers, determining which websites you can go to and cutting special deals, maybe making Yahoo or Netflix the preferred website on their services. It's the idea that the internet would stay neutral and the user determines where to go, and all the websites are treated equally.
And so now, during the Bush administration, the FCC, which ostensibly, at least at this point, regulates these things, they changed the classification of internet carriers. Explain what happened then.
Sure. So throughout the history of telecommunications, there's this broad idea that the networks simply connect people. So if you picked up a phone to call someone, AT&T wouldn't say, no, Marvin, you're not allowed to call Sam. Like, we were blocking that call. Nor could AT&T charge me more for calling you than, you know, calling someone else, you know, in your area. There was a rule called common carrier where the telephone companies had to treat everyone the same and had to provide everyone service, largely. And in the early 2000s, when we started thinking about the internet, which had been governed by telephone rules under dial-up and for a little while under DSL, when the Bush administration had an opportunity, they, quote, deregulated the entire, you know, internet service provider game. And so all of a sudden, it was unclear what rules might apply to Comcast, Verizon, AT&T, and AT&T's CEO, pretty much a few months after the deregulation happened, said, we own the pipes for the internet, and if Google and Yahoo think they're going to use these pipes for free, they're crazy, essentially threatening to block websites and to extort them for cash. It's essentially an extortion model that was made possible by eliminating the rules that we'd had for 100 years for the phone network called common carrier regulation.
And so there was a question during the preceding administration, I guess back in 2010 was this maybe, as to whether or not that classification, they were going to be reclassified as common carriers, and instead the baby was sort of split in half here.
Yeah. Also, I mean, just at a higher level, when you think about what net neutrality ensures, that without net neutrality, a company like AT&T or Verizon can decide to block any website or to simply take a tax on every transaction, right? People like the Bitcoin craze that's going on right now. Without net neutrality, Verizon and AT&T can just decide to take a nickel off of every Bitcoin. And so a few years ago, back in 2008, there was a big case at the FCC having to do with not Bitcoin, but BitTorrent. And Comcast, the largest cable company, was interfering with BitTorrent secretly. And the FCC decided to issue an order stopping Comcast, saying, you've got to stop interfering with these technologies called BitTorrent that a lot of people were using, often legally, sometimes illegally, but people were using at home. Comcast was told to stop. Comcast went to the D.C. Circuit, which is probably the second most powerful court in the nation behind the Supreme Court, and Comcast said that the FCC order was illegal and should be thrown out. And their main argument was the FCC doesn't have the authority to regulate internet service providers because back in 2003 to 2005, the FCC had deregulated everything. And so this would be as though, you know, the financial institutions were deregulated, and then, you know, there's no ability to eventually regulate them when they did something wrong. And that's what the court said. The court said, you know, FCC, you made your bed, lie in it, you can't regulate the ISPs now that you've deregulated them. And then the FCC tried again and adopted an order in 2010 after having lost the case, you know, and they've got a second shot at the apple now to see if they can actually be upheld in court in adopting a net neutrality rule.
And we should say there's two things I want to say here. The D.C. Circuit Court is also in the news because this is the court that the Republicans have blocked now three nominees by the Obama administration. May end up being another story in terms of the filibuster reform. But the Republicans are arguing the caseload's too small there. There's no reason to allow the president to put his appointees on this court, and it still slants heavily with Republican nominees. and so this court essentially rules on nearly every regulation that, at least the ones that we're talking about today. And so
just as a legal matter, you can appeal just about any regulation in that court just because of the way the rules are structured. So many of the most famous and most important rules adopted by any agency, the SEC, the FCC, the EPA, you name it, right? They all go to that court. It's very powerful.
So now, when the FCC back in 2008 had the opportunity to reclassify these internet service providers as common carriers, had they done that at this time, because, I mean, at the very least, you know, as the technology progresses, we realize that we rely on internet service providers in the same way that we do with phone companies. In fact, now, perhaps even more, case in point, you know, you can't get health insurance if you're in a non-group plan unless you have access to the websites. Now, that may change in terms of the Affordable Care Act, but that's just one indication of just how necessary this is. This is no longer a luxury. It is a utility, not unlike a telephone. So could they have avoided this last case before we really start to talk about it? Could they have avoided this had they simply returned the internet service providers to that classification as a common carrier?
Yes, completely. And let me explain this because some people might be unfamiliar with this classification idea. But the FCC essentially could have determined that Comcast and AT&T and Verizon were like networks which had been regulated for 100 years to make sure that they didn't discriminate and become, you know, toll keepers in the middle of the network between all of us. Or they could have decided that Comcast wasn't like a network. It was more like Twitter or Google or Facebook, which are unregulated. And the FCC essentially said, we're going to treat Comcast, Verizon, AT&T like we treat Twitter. And then when the court case happened back in 2009, the FCC had tried to implement net neutrality under their authority, just broad authority, weird authority. And the court said, wait a second, you're telling us that you can enforce net neutrality against Comcast and Verizon under a nebulous authority that might let you regulate Twitter. We don't want you to do that. So either go back and classify Comcast and Verizon properly, or you're not going to get this authority without doing that. When this went back to the FCC after this, I mean, it was a decisive loss. The D.C. Circuit was so clear unanimously that the FCC was not going to be able to do net neutrality unless they did a reclassification. And the FCC chairman at the time, Julius Genachowski, and his general counsel both did like YouTube videos, put out press releases, and said, we're going to reclassify, we're going to remove the deregulation, and we're going to, you know, do the proper and appropriate thing. But then it turns out that Julius Genachowski, the FCC chairman at the time, you know, really had no backbone and was willing to break his promises right when the lobbyists from AT&T and Comcast pushed on him a little bit. And then he spent the next several months kind of running around asking for help from different congressmen, looking for political cover, and finally just buckled and decided not to reclassify. And so if I'm being harsh, I'm just sort of telling the tale that everyone in D.C. had to live through. Really just the lack of backbone by the chairman is why we're in this place right now.
And so that brings us up to this case that is being decided, I guess, theoretically, as we speak, at the D.C. Circuit Court, Verizon versus the FCC. Tell us about this case and why you are less than optimistic.
So this case was Verizon appealing the FCC's order that was adopted a few years ago, but, you know, sort of second attempt, the FCC's second attempt. And when the briefs were filed, and after the briefs are filed in this case, there's an argument where the lawyers from each side argue to the judges, and the judges ask questions. It's usually very hard to predict how a decision will come out based just on the questions. You know, think about the healthcare argument. It would have been hard to predict where Justice Roberts ended up. But this argument seemed a little different. Instead of being just, you know, the hour should have gone half an hour on each side, which itself was longer than most. They allocated more time than usual. They went on for 2 hours. And the judges just stayed as long as it took, ignored all the time limits, and asked, you know, very clearly revealed what they thought about the case and tried to get the lawyers to convince them otherwise. So walking out of that courtroom, all of us understood where the judges were leaning. And where they were leaning was pretty clearly to eliminate net neutrality. Some people were confused by the questions and thought that the court was going to kind of split the baby, you know, they'll uphold part of the rule, strike out the other parts of the rule. But the part of the rule that'll be struck down is the key part of the rule called the non-discrimination rule, the rule that says AT&T and Verizon and Comcast can't discriminate. What might be upheld is this idea that AT&T and Verizon only can't block websites. But if you slow down some websites by a few seconds or make them unreliable, you might as well be blocking them.
Right.
And if AT&T and Verizon are going to set themselves up as a toll booth, taking a fraction of a penny on each iTunes download, you know, putting a tax on Amazon, and taking a piece of every Coinbase transaction in Bitcoin, right, none of that is actually blocking. But they can just set themselves up as the middlemen of the Internet and really eliminate all the great innovation and freedom that we've had online.
So, I mean, just to put this in more, I guess, narcissistic terms, in this, you know, after this ruling, I may want to go and partner with Verizon if I want to make sure that my podcast, my internet streaming is given priority. Perhaps they will charge my competitors a little bit extra, maybe a lot extra, to reach the audience. And so this is going to this is like the sort of the functional equivalent of the almost the Sinn Féin, the syndication distribution laws that were rolled back for movies. But there's no alternative. Movies obviously can be delivered now in a myriad of different ways. It's just not the case when you're talking about the Internet.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to the Internet, generally the local cable company holds the dominant share, and there's only one competitor, which is maybe the DSL in town. So generally the cable companies will have a huge say of what you can see and what you can't, and you'll probably have to go cut deals if Verizon and Comcast have their way. And the real economic model they're channeling is, you know, from The Sopranos, right? It's sort of just they get their cut of everything. They get control and cut of everything because they have the last mile pipe into people's home as a result of 100 years of regulation and being regulated as a monopoly that is now benefited while they're unregulated.
When Jankowski sort of refused to make this this change back to the classification as a common carrier, was this predictable?
Yeah, this was completely predictable. Everyone knew at the time that it would be a very, very, very hard road. And people were handicapping it at, you know, 10% chance of being upheld. And I think I wrote an article explaining that we had clearly built our house on sand, and it was going to be knocked down. It was unquestionable. I mean, if I'm wrong, I'd be ecstatic, but I'm fairly certain that the non-discrimination rule will be struck down. And I think once you lose that, you don't have net neutrality. And it's not clear that there's much political will left in D.C. after, you know, AT&T and Verizon and Comcast, some of the most powerful lobbying organizations. I mean, they make Hollywood look like wimps when it comes to lobbying. And these guys, I think, have really beaten down the congressmen and the FCC to a point where, and the tech companies who have to cut deals with them already, to the point where I'm pretty pessimistic that we'll be able to reverse the decision.
So, I mean, but Jankowski must have been aware of this too, right? I mean,
he knew for sure. He knew completely. He had, I mean, the day that, the, you know, shortly after the decision came out, the Comcast decision, the one that had, you know, said the FCC doesn't have authority without reclassifying, you know, shortly after that, the chairman made a YouTube video saying he was going to reclassify. His general counsel, you can find these blog posts, said we're going to reclassify. It's the only way forward. We thought about this. That's a very clear, it was a very clear decision. And then it just turned out that, you know, the political lobbying was too powerful for Jankowski, who was already known to cave the lobbying. He was well known in D.C. and in press reports. And then, you know, it was the number one fight for a long time, trying to get the chairman to propose reclassification, and one of the other Democrats. When they agreed to vote for the order with him, you know, said that they had wished he had reclassified. So, I mean, it was completely predictable. I think he just figured he'd be gone before the mass of the case happened, and he is. He's no longer chairman.
What telecommunications company is he working for? Do you know?
He's not working for a telecommunications company. I'm not going to psychoanalyze him. I just think he didn't. You know, he was known.
Well, then hope springs eternal. I guess that's in other words, without getting too deep into the weeds about what Verizon is arguing, they're arguing some type of almost a First Amendment principle, as if they were a newspaper, because they are not classified as a common carrier. There are more arguments available to them, and so from a legal perspective, it's almost as if their case is somewhat legitimate because of the way that they're classified. They're just simply not considered, and that's sort of the original sin. They're not considered a need to have type of utility like the phone or, you know, I guess electricity.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I had even forgotten about the most ridiculous argument, because it hardly came up during the oral argument for the case. The most ridiculous argument, which has some credence because of what Julia Jankowski did, is we, Verizon and Comcast and AT&T, we the people who provide access to the Internet, are speakers just like intrepid publishers and newspapers, and we can edit the Internet. We have a First Amendment right to edit the kinds of things that are on the Internet, just like a newspaper has a First Amendment right to edit what's in their newspaper. And essentially what they're saying is that their ability to censor websites and to block your ability to post on Twitter or WordPress, that they have a First Amendment right to censor you. And one of the judges really liked the argument, one of the three, but the other two didn't seem to buy it.
But nevertheless, this is where we are. And so when do we anticipate the court issuing a ruling?
It could be any day. It might be in the new year. People are predicting around January. I mean, one thing that I noticed, especially from that Wired article, is that even though people in D.C., you know, will say, oh, this is an old issue, you know, we're sick of this issue, or we're tired of being lobbied on it, apparently the American public cares. I mean, when I wrote that article, I didn't expect it to go. It went pretty insanely viral for an article with the word net neutrality in it. I mean, it was by far number one on Wired for many days, front page on Reddit, front page on Huffington Post. It was shared widely, and that gave a lot of people who care about the issue and work on net neutrality, you know, some hope, a glimmer of hope they hadn't had. And so I do think that the public participation and the fact that the public still cares about this issue for obvious reasons, I think that's great. I mean, it's really important.
Give me a sense of now. Presumably, the ruling comes down if they find in favor of Verizon. Then basically the shackles are off. AT&T, Verizon, Comcast, they will all race to begin to sort of collect their different preferred whatever it is, music providing services, podcast service, whatever it is.
It'll all be more subtle than that. The decision will come out, and people might be a little confused by it. AT&T and Verizon and maybe a lot of politicians will say, look, the baby was split. It was a compromise decision. Don't worry about it. Everyone go home. When if the non-discrimination rule is struck down, as it will be, it's game over. Net neutrality is dead. They'll say, oh, don't worry. It's a compromise. And then they'll roll out some services and features, you know, maybe deeper in the network when it comes to caching. You know, if you don't pay for their caching services, then your services won't load quickly. You don't pay for this service or that service. And then eventually, users will start to see it and it'll be more out in the open. But, they'll try to, it's almost like this story about the frog in boiling water. I'm sure that's what they'll try to do.
Right. So soon we'll have the opportunity to be a Verizon Extreme customer where we get, faster loads on your favorite websites that all happen to either pay a carriage fee to Verizon or are owned by Verizon. So let me ask you this then. Assuming people like yourself and those of us who care about this issue are able to mobilize people, they would theoretically push on the FCC to go back to the original, returning back to the classification as a common carrier. What are the chances, as the FCC is made up now, that they may have sympathetic ears?
You know, it's hard to know. So the Republicans will be opposed to net neutrality. It's become a partisan, almost religious issue. When they tried to defund the government or whatever, net neutrality was part of it. But they're fighting the health care reform, net neutrality. It's from religious for the Republicans. So the three Democrats, include two women and then the chairman, Tom Wheeler. And I think the two women would probably be votes for reclassification, Mignon Clyburn and Commissioner Jessica Rosenworcel. I'm just guessing. The chairman is brand new, a guy named Tom Wheeler. He has gotten rave reviews from people, but he was the former head lobbyist for the cable industry, and then after that, the former head lobbyist of the wireless industry. And so the hope that he will be able to do the right thing is mainly based on the fact that he actually understands the industries. He can call BS, and the wireless industry that he was the head lobbyist for was always regulated under Title II, and they still made money hand over fist and served people. So,
well, all right. Hope springs eternal, and so people should be aware of that name, Tom Wheeler, because hopefully you'll be sending emails and letters to him in the coming months. Well, I guess really hopefully you won't have to.
And one final point: the organization that's sort of taken the lead over the last few years in fighting for net neutrality is called Free Press at freepress.net. And hopefully they'll be organizing a lot of the public sentiment.
Marvin Amori, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam.
All right, we are jam-packed today, so let's go right into the interview I did with Adam Green last week from the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. Here it is. We are back on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program again the co-founder of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee at boldprogressives.org, Adam Green. Adam, welcome back to the program.
Sam, fantastic to be here.
Now, Adam, we spoke I don't want to have to do the math, but about 4 or 5 months ago at Netroots Nation. And one of the things that we spoke about was the idea of Social Security perhaps being on the table as part of some type of grand bargain. And at that time, I believe we discussed the idea of Social Security having to be expanded. And you were talking about how the PCCC was pushing for that, and it was a, you know, it was one of those things like, yeah, pipe dream to at least see some type of movement. And in 7 months, that whole narrative has completely changed.
Yeah, you know, this is a really great example of how having a progressive movement distinct from the Democratic Party can make a difference, and how real strategizing by regular people can make a difference. So I think I actually talked to you about an hour after there was a meeting among a number of progressive groups, you know, us at the Progressive Change Campaign Committee and Move On, Democracy for America, Social Security Works, and several others around the table. And we really wanted to think about how to engage in the Social Security fight. And, you know, my main pitch in that room was, you know, we've been playing really smart defense by rallying around things like the Grayson-Takano letter, where members of the House firmly said that they would vote against any grand bargain that had cuts to Social Security, Medicare, or Medicaid benefits. But the best defense is a good offense. Why don't we go on offense and rally around these bills that were kind of just in the hopper but not really being mobilized around by Tom Harkin from the rural state of Iowa and Mark Begich from the red state of Alaska, you know, one of the four Democrats that voted against gun reform, kind of has, you know, has his moderate credentials intact, and he was out there with a bill to expand Social Security benefits. And we talked about it and decided to mobilize around it. So we actually hadn't been mobilizing yet. I think I was fresh off of that meeting when we talked. And, you know, since then, you know, what we did was we treated it basically as a product launch. So we actually worked with progressive media, in this case Ed Schultz, to arrange for both senators to be on MSNBC to basically kick off the campaign. And all these groups that represent millions of people all launched our campaign around this, around that interview. We wanted to make sure that it was seen as very credible by our members, because it was. And, you know, we've gone now from those two to, you know, six senators this week. We got both senators from Hawaii, including Brian Schatz, a really progressive freshman senator. Just about 2 weeks ago, Sherrod Brown from the presidential swing state of Ohio announced his endorsement of this concept to our email list. And this week, on the floor of the Senate, after progressives were attacked by the editorial page of the Washington Post, Elizabeth Warren went to the floor of the Senate, proudly announced her endorsement of expanding Social Security, and debunked the Washington Post editorial. There's also about 40 brave members of the House who are out there. So the fact that we've gone from having it be this very nascent idea that you and I pretty much talked about for the first time outside of that meeting to the Washington Post editorial pages, and thanks to Elizabeth Warren, you know, The Nation magazine, The Atlantic, Slate and others, and last night again on MSNBC with Chris Hayes, like we've taken this into the mainstream. And one final point, you know, our goal for the year was not to pass Social Security expansion. It was to make it credible enough by the end of the year that it was in the mainstream political discourse and enter 2014 from a position where we could then go to the progressive candidates that we'll be supporting and ask them to actively campaign on this message, spend millions of dollars in ads about this message, go on offense for a change instead of just saying we won't end Medicare. And I think we're well set up to do that now.
And the idea, I mean, just, you know, the idea that anyone could now propose the idea of cutting Social Security, it seems even that much more far removed from what the national conversation is. I mean, it's been fascinating to see how this has gained steam. And certainly, and one person we've left out, which we really should credit, I think, in my mind, who helped also mainstream this idea a year or so ago was Duncan Black, who you know, started writing op-eds about this in USA Today at a time where this idea was considered by all accounts as lunacy. And I mean, we're not even talking on a policy level here. On a policy level, there's a lot of reasons, even ones adopted by you know, folks like Ezra Klein, as to why this thing should be happening. But to get this into the conventional narrative, I think, has really been a stunning victory.
I agree, and you're absolutely right. Atreus, Duncan Black deserves a lot of credit. There were thought leaders who thought about this idea well before we mobilized around it. What I just described was kind of the mobilization strategy, given that there were some very great senators who happened to offer these bills. I should also mention, by the way, that we did polling with some of the groups, including Credo Action, one of the proud sponsors of this show.
Indeed.
We did polling and found that, in the red state of Kentucky, the purple state of Colorado, and the blue state of California, expanding Social Security benefits was popular by 2-1. And in the deep red state of Texas, and again, the purple state of Colorado, it was 3-1. I should have said Iowa before, actually. So 2-1, 3-1 margins, no matter what state we're talking about. The White House plan to cut Social Security benefits was popular by no more than 15% in each of these states. No more than 15% of the public supported them. So, when you look at the White House plan to cut benefits and this progressive push to expand benefits, one of these is the more politically smart position in addition to being good policy. And it's the progressive position.
And so give me a sense. I mean, do you have an inkling as you go into 2014 and you begin to try and convince electeds, particularly I would imagine in the House as well, who are up for re-election, do you have a sense of I mean, I know you haven't sort of necessarily formally begun this process, but do you have a sense of how responsive people are to it? In other words, are you finding is it something that is being digested by candidates?
So far it's been put on the radar of a lot of incumbents because they're in Congress and they see their colleagues in both, the House and the Senate beginning to rally around this bill. And, as we begin to, have real deep conversations with candidates, challengers in the campaign trail, it's part and parcel of our conversation. It's one of the top questions of our Progressive Change Campaign Committee questionnaire. And, others are doing it as well. And I will say that, there's actually two races to watch where this will likely be a important primary issue. In Hawaii, Brian Schatz, again, this freshman senator in his early 40s, really smart, strategic guy, he is being primaried kind of from the right by a member of the House named Colleen Hanabusa, and he is actively out there as one of the initial people on this Social Security expansion bill. She refused to sign the Grayson Takano letter saying that she wouldn't cut benefits or even the weaker version of that letter. So there's a great contrast there of someone who won't even, make a commitment about cuts versus somebody who totally stands for expansion. And we have a parallel situation in a California primary where Mike Honda, one of the leading progressive caucus members in the House, is out there on the Social Security expansion bill, and his kind of corporate Democrat opponent is very kind of wishy-washy on the question of even cuts, let alone expansion. So we're going to be prioritizing those races as well as working with some challengers in the weeks and months ahead to really get out there publicly. And again, my hope is that we're not just talking about this issue, but candidates do the polling, realize that even in the deep red state of Texas, this is popular by 3-1, and spend millions of dollars educating the public, featuring everyday senior citizens who would benefit, whose corporate pensions have been cut, and who rely on Social Security and need an increase, not a decrease.
And the idea is, the hope is that those primary races will provide, because this is how it works, these primary races then get ballyhooed as a bellwether on this issue, and it becomes that much easier and that much more incumbent upon incumbents, or I guess theoretically potential challengers, to adopt this position, just speaking strictly on a political level.
Yeah, I mean, the primaries are a very important piece of that puzzle. Another piece of the puzzle that we learned last cycle, and I think you and I spoke about and Net Rich Nation, is the polling. And what I mean by that is, part of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee model is working very deeply with candidates. The contrast is these big money independent expenditures that, pretty much by law don't coordinate with candidates. And what we found last cycle was when we were able to really reach out to candidates early in the cycle and, be part of their inner circle and, become privy to the first draft of their poll, oftentimes pollsters in D.C. don't poll progressive messaging. Right. It's not always that they're bad people, although sometimes they are. It's often that just that they have no agenda. There's no boundaries. There's no conversation that they're trying to expand. There's no way that they want to win. They just want to win, even if it's on the most small bore or petty issue, but that totally impacts the way that people govern, right? If you got elected on a small issue, you are disincentivized to think big and, you know, be bold when you're in there. So, you know, last cycle there was this one race where, we recommended a question that basically said that, you know, candidate X believes that Wall Street bankers broke the law, illegally took away people's homes, wrecked our economy, and Wall Street bankers who broke the law should go to jail. And, you know, the pollster put it in the poll, and it ended up being the number one question popular in the entire poll. And what that did was it got the entire consultant class for that campaign on board with actively spending money around this message. And that results in, you know, voter education, the, you know, public education. And if we can do that on lots of races this cycle and basically get candidates to spend millions of dollars that they're going to spend anyway, but do it on big, bold ideas like this, well, that would be a major step forward in the right direction. So I think it's a combination of the primary and also really just making the candidates prove to themselves through their own polling that Social Security expansion is very popular.
It's both fascinating and sort of alternatingly fascinating and scary on some level that the idea of just being of developing a relationship to ultimately have one line in a poll can have such dramatic influence. But it's frankly brilliant of you guys to have figured it out, you guys have done a good job of executing it. So let me ask you another question that is not exactly situated on the same topics, but when we see the problems with healthcare.gov, we see the media narrative about the problems with the rollout for Obamacare. I've been stumping for the past couple of days, but I mean, is there anybody out there who's talking about addressing these problems, real or imagined, frankly? And I imagine in my sense is they're actually in some respects more imagined in terms of the size and scope of these problems. But the idea that if you are upset that your policy has been canceled, as a function of the Affordable Care Act, then the government has the responsibility to make sure that you are situated okay. We are going to offer you a Medicare buy-in, let's say,
exactly.
Which would have been, you know, sort of analogous to the public option, but maybe that word is too toxic. But is there anybody out there who is applying these same tactics of going on the offense, trying to push this legislation in a more progressive direction, leaving aside the policy and the technical and the wonkish aspects of it, but just from a rhetorical standpoint, is there anybody out there who's contemplating, who is doing this, who's organizing around it?
Not yet, but hopefully. And I completely agree with you. This is what progressives need to do right now to not just change the conversation away from the kind of negative place it is now, but to really go on offense similar to what we're doing in Social Security and fundamentally, you know, change what people perceive as possible in a way that will help millions of people. You know, I'll tell you, the last, pretty much since 2010, since the Affordable Care Act passed, whenever we talk to candidates about this particular issue, the public option or a Medicare buy-in for all, a typical response, not everybody, but most people, even good progressives, say, well, you know what, let's give Obamacare a chance to work first, right? They didn't want to rock the boat. They didn't want to be perceived as saying something that would kind of throw cold water on Obamacare. But, you know, we now have a national narrative about how Obamacare isn't working, whether, you know, we think that's fair or not fair. And what it means is, you know, similar to, you know, the shock doctrine idea, like this is a crisis, and we have an opportunity to either fall prey to this crisis or go on offense and utilize the fact that there is now a conversation about what to do to improve Obamacare to our advantage, right? So, last week I actually talked to a member of Congress about this idea, and it turns out that she was also thinking about it, had some actual specific policy questions about how it would work. And, you know, last couple of days I've been talking to some of the healthcare policy wonks who know a lot more about this than I do to try to see if we can answer her questions and see if we can get a vehicle launched. You know, my guess is that if just one member of Congress was bold enough to offer some bill that would amend Obamacare to allow a Medicare buy-in in the exchange, that we would have a huge outpouring of public support. And like Social Security, we would change the debate. So I guess the best answer I can give you is we're working on it, and hopefully that'll come through.
Well, that's the right answer.
It's the right instinct.
That's the answer I wanted to hear. Because, I mean, at the very least, you know, this also raises it allows progressives to say, look, you know, we're going to accept that there's some things may be problematic on a technical level, but we also, you know, implicit in this solution is also the distinction between the sort of neoliberal aspects of Obamacare that we may not like or that we do not like, this notion of it being, you know, we're seeing a private-public partnership being touted as being socialism. I say let's go more towards a social insurance solution for this. And so it's good to hear that you guys are working on it.
Absolutely. And, you know, thanks for, you know, Social Security expansion and this. You know, it takes shows like this to really give these issues a voice. You know, you don't hear about that kind of stuff on CNN, for instance. But it takes, you know, I know that while we were putting together some of the formative stages of the Social Security expansion campaign, you know, I would hear about it repeatedly on this show. And can I just take a tangent for a moment?
Please.
To talk about progressive infrastructure. So I'm actually a $10 a month member. Going into 2014, I have decided that I'm going to up that to the $19.99 membership, which I guess is a Cedarista.
Hold on for a second.
The reason is,
you're getting one of these. Actually, I'm even going to give you one of these, too.
That was overwhelming. Thank you. no, but I just want to, you know, explain how important this is. And I think I can vouch for this idea because we're also an organization at boldprogressives.org that, you know, basically is fueled and independent because of small dollar donations. You know, unlike the big Koch brother funded operations that, you know, get millions of dollars from a single source and in some cases just need to figure out how to spend it, progressive infrastructure is woefully underfunded. And I think anybody who has built an organization, an enterprise, you know, like the Majority Report, like the Progressive Change Campaign Committee knows that, you know, we know exactly what we would do with the next $50,000 in the door, the next $10,000 in the door. You know, there are big things to be done with the next amount of money. The utility is very high. And, you know, I'm somebody who goes for a jog or goes to the grocery store and doesn't want to waste my time while I'm doing it, so I listen to progressive media, including the Majority Report. The app has actually revolutionized my life and made it so much easier. And that takes money to build, right? Yeah. And we build technology as well. So for people who are the freebie people, you know, as you consider, you know, 2 cups of coffee in your next month, maybe 3 cups, depending on what kind of coffee. You know, give it to progressive infrastructure. There is nothing more valuable to the conversation. You know, nothing will impact more people's lives than getting the conversation started on things like expanding Social Security benefits and having a Medicare buy-in for all. And it all has to start with those who are crafting the conversation, and that's progressive media. So that's my pitch. It's really earnest. I really hope that somebody right now will go to their computer and sign up. Sam didn't ask me to do this. But, you know, again, as somebody who's built kind of an entrepreneurial progressive organization, I really think that it's important that everyday people understand, you know, how this works and how important those donations are.
Well, so, Adam, thank you for that. And I guess we will be talking to you tomorrow, and then we will have you on the show the following day. next week. Adam, thank you very much. I appreciate it. And, you know, it's I really – well, we've you know – you know how much I appreciate what you guys are doing, and this Social Security thing has been amazing. The work that you guys did with Elizabeth Warren, also amazing, and it is it's encouraging. It really is. So, Adam Green, the site is boldprogressives.org, Progressive Change Campaign Committee. Thanks so much for your time today.
Yep. Thank you, Sam. Take care.
All right, folks, went a little long today with the freebie show. I don't think I need to sell it to you. I think Adam Green did a great job. He will be back tomorrow and the next day and every day. You can also support this program by giving us a review on iTunes. That is very helpful to pushing us up the charts. You can go to go to iTunes and review us at Majority FM. I think if you go to majority.fm/review, it'll take you to a link. You can also get our app at majorityapp.com. You can also help us out if you buy any crap through Amazon. go to majoritereportkickback.com, click on the link, bookmark